Hello, and welcome to Week in Review, your weekly roundup of news and analysis from OnFIF around the world. I'm Julie Levi-Bignoli. Today, we're talking about inflation rates in the post-pandemic era, COVID-19 lessons for green finance, more reactions to the German Constitutional Court ruling on the Bundesbank's role in quantitative easing, and the financial consequences of stimulus transmission. All that and more coming right up. Welcome to this edition of Week in Review. We published two pieces this week discussing what effect the pandemic could have on inflation rates. Gary Smith, Managing Director of Sovereign Focus, wrote, "Forecasts of where the inflation rate might go have rarely been so dispersed. The economic consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic have led simultaneously to predictions that we are heading into a period of deflation, and that over the medium term, inflation rates could reach 10% or higher. Whichever view proves to be correct, a decade of stable inflation rates may be coming to an end. Most economists accept that over the short term, the consequence of the global collapse in consumer demand will be a decline in inflation rates, and possibly even a move into deflation. The fall in demand will leave a surplus of supply in many sectors, and there will be immediate downward pressure on prices. The oil price drop is a good example of this, and was a key input into the declining headline inflation rates for March in all but two of the G20 nations. Economists agree that further declines in headline inflation rates are probable into the summer, but there are significant differences of opinion on how the data might evolve over the next 12 months. Those predicting an inflation bounce highlight several factors. First, they expect to see a trend for global supply chains to be reversed. Bringing production back to a home nation would probably mean higher costs in terms of labor and materials, and could lead to a need to maintain permanently higher inventory levels. Second, they cite the recent policy announcements from central banks and governments. They expect a surge in the supply of money in the economy, and as the textbook tells us, too much money chasing too few goods will result in higher inflation. Those predicting low inflation or deflation do not expect a V-shaped economic recovery. They argue that the collapse in demand has already been so severe that a situation of excess supply will persist for many months. They believe that flattening the curve of COVID-19 infection is more consistent with an L-shaped economic recovery. They foresee each easing in lockdown rules allowing more oxygen to get to the fire that is the pandemic, extending its duration and increasing the chance of a second wave of infections. This managed but prolonged scenario will mean there will not be a magical day when the crisis ends and a spending splurge commences. Much postponed discretionary spending will in fact become lost forever. It looks as though the long-run trend of stability in the inflation rate is ending, and we need to prepare for an inflation rate roller coaster. OnFIF economist Chris Papadopoulos also covered inflation this week, describing it as a fiscal phenomenon. Chris wrote, "Money and credit numbers have gone haywire in recent weeks as households have stopped spending and companies have borrowed heavily to shore up their cash balances. The sudden spike in corporate borrowing has led to a rapid increase in broad money. But this is likely to be temporary. Corporates are relying on short-term financing to see them through the next few months, and many will have limited borrowing capacity. They will be borrowing heavily to stay afloat as sales dry up and to shore up their cash balances in case lending conditions are less savoury down the line. While the private sector's sudden borrowing binge may prove short-lived, the public sector's will not. Accounting for government borrowing, Tim Congdon, chairman of the Institute for International Monetary Research, forecasts higher inflation going into 2021, with money growth in the US, UK and EU at its highest rate since the 1970s, when inflation reached double digits in many advanced economies. Even if the private sector's borrowing is momentary, government deficits will propel money growth. These forecasts, though, are subject to the usual caveats. One of these will relate to demand by the private sector to hold money. Much of the increase in money growth over March and April was due to the private sector wanting to increase its cash balance. The demand for money rose and the supply increase matched it. Higher money demand will last as long as the crisis. How much the government is prepared to borrow is another consideration. The implication of more money is higher inflation, but that is not necessarily a bad thing. A bit of inflation, if temporary and demand-led, helps the private and public sector to deleverage so they can spend more on consumption and investment rather than servicing debts. If inflation is demand-led, it need not reduce savings and income, as rising income will be the cause of inflation, and savings will benefit from higher asset prices and interest rates. These factors will determine inflation later in the year. Changes to spending patterns obscure the near-term outlook. This week, we continued our series on the German Constitutional Court ruling on the Bundesbank's participation in European quantitative easing. One of the pieces we published was by John Nucci, senior advisor to OMFIF, who wrote, "The dispute between Germany's Constitutional Court and the European Central Bank is a major challenge to the legal structures of the European Union and the heart of the European project. For the ECB, the ruling is an irritant and creates work at a challenging time. But the ECB is not seriously threatened. Even if it was, politicians would ensure it survived. They might even misquote former ECB President Mario Draghi and say, within our mandate, we are prepared to do whatever it takes to preserve the ECB. The central bank thinks it has a good enough defense of what it has done and will therefore agree, or condescend, to go along with the demand for a review. It is happy to play its part because it expects the process not to derail what it is doing. But this is a high-stakes game, and it is not clear what happens if the review's conclusion is that they cannot proceed. For over 60 years, the EU has been like Schrödinger's cat, half supranational, half intergovernmental. Until someone opens the box to test it, it will stay in this halfway state. The German court has opened the box. The European Court of Justice's fear is that in doing so, it might force a resolution of the question, and the answer might be that the EU is, in fact, an intergovernmental body, in which case the superstructure of supranationalism, including the authority of the Commission, the position of the ECJ, and the status and supremacy of EU law, might evaporate. Far too much has been invested in the EU for the member states to allow this to happen, but in preventing it, the EU might be forced into some awkward compromises. As part of this series, our chairman, David Marsh, reported back from a briefing with Marcel Fratscher, president of the Berlin-based DIW Economic Research Institute, who believes the ECB is likely to raise significantly its €750 billion emergency bond buying program next month to counter pandemic-induced risks of euro area fragmentation. The central bank, says Fratscher, has to show it is unconstrained by last week's German Constitutional Court ruling. You can download the full transcript of their conversation on omfif.org. The world finds itself in the midst of an unprecedented crisis with tragic loss of life and long-lasting economic consequences. But the pandemic must not serve as an excuse to undermine efforts to climate-proof the financial system, wrote Aziz Durrani, senior financial sector specialist at the Southeast Asian Central Bank's Research and Training Center, and Ulrich Voltz, director of the SOAS Center for Sustainable Finance. A parallel can be drawn between the current crisis and the climate crisis. For years, scientists have warned about the probability of a pandemic, yet governments around the world cut health budgets, including those aimed at dealing with situations like COVID-19. Similarly, scientists have long warned of a climate catastrophe. The financial sector has a key role to play. Financial institutions fund the activities of the companies contributing to global warming and environmental damage. When making decisions on loans and investments, the financial system must fully consider the cost of economic activities that cause environmental destruction, pollution, and biodiversity loss. The sector must be better prepared to deal with systemic risks, including climate and other environmental hazards. Central banks are showing greater awareness of sustainability risks and acknowledging the need for them to help align the financial system with sustainable development. But calls have emerged from the financial industry to delay prudential measures aimed at addressing climate risks. Without doubt, this is a period of great stress for our economies and the financial sector, and pragmatism and flexibility are needed to manage this situation where so much is at stake. But if anything, the pandemic should strengthen the financial sector's resolve to speed up efforts to integrate environmental and climate risks in financial decision-making to prevent the next crisis. Finally, our Chief Executive Officer, John Orchard, spoke with EY's David Barker for part two of our special series with EY on the economic response measures to the COVID-19 crisis. In this edition, they discuss the shock and awe measures deployed by governments to rescue their economies and the short and medium-term implications for their finance ministries. What are the paths out of the emergency schemes? How are governments planning to restart their economies? And what will it mean for their finances? How is this crisis fundamentally reordering their priorities in both developed and emerging economies? For all the answers to these questions, head to omfif.org, where you can listen to the recording of their conversation and read the full transcript. Coming up next week, we have meetings covering many different topics and many different regions. On Tuesday, 19th of May, Benjamin Diokno, Governor of the Philippine Central Bank, discusses the structural challenges facing the country, getting the right policy mix to build the new economy post-pandemic, and the long-term outlook for the economy. The same day, Jacob von Weizsäcker, Chief Economist in the German Finance Ministry, gives an overview of the state of the German economy and Europe's response to COVID-19. Also on Tuesday, Ron Feldman, First Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, discusses the relevance of too big to fail during the pandemic and the effectiveness of the regulation introduced since 2008. On Wednesday, 20th of May, Krishnamurti Subramaniam, Chief Economic Advisor to the Government of India, discusses India's spending plans, structural reforms, and the country's future role in the world economy. The same day, Irina Asmundson, Chief Economist at the California Department of Finance, discusses both the immediate fiscal response to COVID-19 and the long-term policy outlook to deal with the consequences of the economic downturn. And that is all for this edition of Week in Review. To read more about everything we've discussed, visit omfif.org or scroll down to the notes underneath this podcast, where you will find links to everything mentioned today. To stay up to date with OMFIF news, analysis, and forthcoming meetings, sign up at omfif.org/sports.